good horse, I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse.
As long as you can convince people that all this poverty, although it's needless, is really part of economic nature, they'll be satisfied.
Taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight.
You're listening to episode 551 of Unwelcome Guests, Understanding the Financial Crisis. I'm Robin Upton. That was Michael Hudson, Professor of Economics. I'm not a Professor of Economics, but I've got a thing or two to say about the financial crisis. Like him, I think a lot of it is a scam. There's a lot of nonsense talked by people who try and make it seem complex, but at the end of the day are a small group of selfish people using power and influence for selfish gain. We're going to hear more from Michael Hudson in our second hour, but first, I'm going to speak about a presentation I've made. It's number AE602, so if you type that into Google, I think it'll be somewhere in the top 10. Alternatively, you can download it directly from altruists.org/AE602. Having the presentation would help, but it's not necessary. I'm going to explain the key features of the 28 slides as and when they appear. The title is Understanding the Financial Crisis, with crisis in quotes, because the main message of this presentation is that it's not a crisis. Certainly nothing like a natural disaster. It's not an earthquake or a tsunami, which unforeseen. This is something that has been foreseen, and it's something that's been deliberately created, and it's something that's inevitable. The first slide is the contents. I'm breaking this presentation down into six bits. Part one, on the coming change. Part two, a convenient untruth, which is going to talk about how the coming change is being presented to a world that doesn't want to have to admit this as a slip of accounting. Section 3, wrong questions, looking at how commercial media in particular have been misleading people, helping them to think in unproductive and unhelpful ways about what's going on, confusing them basically by asking the wrong questions. Part 4, which explains how easy this is, money psychosis, looking at how understanding of the real world has been eclipsed for many people by focusing on money. So having understood the gravity of the problem, we're then moving on to part 5, my predictions for the future, and part 6, concluding, offering some important questions, questions you won't hear asked by commercial media, ones that will help us to understand and to navigate the coming period of turmoil. So, part one, the coming change. These ideas will be already familiar to listeners of Unwelcome Guests. First point, that there is a change coming, whether people like it or not. We can't keep doing what we're doing. We've heard from innumerable scientists that any one of multiple areas, there's going to be a crisis. We're going to be running out of oil, running out of metals, fresh water, running out of unpolluted land, cutting down rainforest, running out of fish in the oceans, losing species diversity, shortage of oxygen, the ozone layer is being eroded. Pick your trouble. The current system of exponential growth and exploitation of resources is not going to keep exploiting resources when they're gone. You can look at it the other way. Look at the outputs of this wave of human activity. There will be too much of other things, too many greenhouse gases, too much heat, too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, dioxins, pollution, radiation, disease, pick your poison. There's going to be too much of it because the current system is producing it at an ever-increasing rate without concern to what this is doing to the rest of the world. Right, note that also most people don't actually want to live this way. A coming change is not bad news for these people. There are millions around the world slaving away in terrible conditions in sweatshops. Millions are facing the reality of ecological collapse. They can't keep growing food the way that people have been growing food in their family for generations. And note also in the US, people have not been as happy as they used to be. Reported happiness levels peaked nearly 60 years ago. So although people are using more and more stuff, it's not doing what they need. This is a graph of oil discoveries against oil production. I'd call it oil extraction. You can see that the lines crossed in about 1980. So that year, the world extracted as much oil as it discovered. If it could sustain that, it could keep pulling oil out of the ground forever. But of course, the rate of discoveries had already peaked. That peaked sometime in the 1960s. And every year, people are discovering less oil and taking more out of the ground. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to note that isn't going to continue. And note that what's true of oil is true of other minerals. Firstly, energy itself is essential to extraction of all these minerals, but the minerals themselves exist only in a finite amount. So new copper discoveries, for example, peaked in 1996, and with the amount of copper being used going up and up, at some point it's going to have the same phenomenon, peak copper. So that, I think, is some fairly non-controversial ecological background. Now, look at the money system, how this works. A very simple diagram. We have banks at the top who are creating money out of nothing, giving it to borrowers who are then paying back the same money plus a bit of interest. Now, where does that interest come from? If you read economics textbooks, it talks about, well, that's the profit that you can get from doing business. And you have to give back a bit of that to the bank. It's only fair because the bank created that money out of nothing. Okay, the textbooks don't tell you they created it out of nothing. Textbooks say, well, businesses need banks to help them do business, so it's only fair that they should cut them in on the profits. But I'm not interested in looking at a single business. I'm looking at the aggregate. Because if one business makes a profit, it gets that money from someone else, thus putting them in more of a bind because they're deeper in debt. On aggregate, borrowers take money from banks, pay back that money, plus extra money. And now they're not allowed to create money. Money is only allowed to be created by banks. So, where does the money for interest come from? Answer, next year's loans, because there's a time lag. So the title of the slide is Perpetual Growth, because the money supply has to grow perpetually in order for there not to be a wave of bankruptcies. This slide is on the power of money, which rests on a shared belief. People don't actually need money. It's a delusion which seems convincing because it's shared, because if everyone else going around saying things like, oh, I need some more money, we all need money to live, then it's easy to internalize that. As we know, there are people who are living without using money in Britain, in the US, in Germany, as well, of course, as innumerable people around the world, and say nothing of hunter-gatherers, people who've found alternative ways of meeting their real needs, needs for shelter, needs for food, for useful activity, needs for companionship. They meet their real needs without using money. Now, this is a minority practice in the so-called developed countries. It seems to me to be a forward-thinking practice, because looking at resource scarcity, looking at a future of having less ecological capacity to produce food, I can only foresee rises in food prices and increased scarcity. We may well find that methods which seemed convenient, such as money, because they're dominated by a psychopathic few committed to an ideology of perpetual growth, an ideology which doesn't value human beings as intrinsic worth, which values them only as productive units, that's not a system that I want to be a part of. Why then do so many people believe they do need money? Well, it fits with their life experience. Many of them have grown up thinking, yes, of course I need food, of course I need a house, how am I going to get that? Ah, money. So they confuse a strategy for meeting their needs, buying them, and what they need to fulfill that strategy, money, with the goods themselves. Now, this may seem like a small point, as I think it's going to be increasingly important to detach from fictional needs, such as money, and to focus only on meeting real needs. Why is this so hard for people? Well, there's a big psychology of previous investment. When you've been committed to something for a long time, it takes a lot of psychological effort and upheaval to admit, no, that was a dead end, I'm not going to go there anymore, I'm going to give up on that. People don't want to do that. And that, I think, explains some of the reason why people are so committed to the modern money system, in spite of the fact that an objective evaluation would say, well, continuing this is not in these people's interests. Well, perhaps it's a human tendency to try and abbreviate a complex set of needs by saying, well, all I need is money. But we shouldn't underestimate the concerted apparatus of those who control the money system, and that is their privilege. If I start telling people what to do and how to do it, they're likely to remain uninterested. If I get a wallet full of banknotes out and wave them at people, then yes, I have slaves everywhere, people who are willing to do just what I say, just how I like it, sir, as long as they get my money. And so the financially wealthy are elite and powerful only to the extent that people need this money that they're handing out. And of course, that's why the money system in its modern form doesn't give money, it lends it out, and creating a perpetual shortage of wealth. Now, those super wealthy who are in that position are able to control, as we've looked at several times on the show, media systems, so commercial entertainment, governments largely, large organizations, and the net effect of all their policies is to reinforce people's delusion that money is what they need. What's called economic development has made many people reliant on the money system for their survival. A community of people without money, in which some farm, some teach, some do other things, but they exchange their fruits of their labor without using money, is not a system that money has any power over. Nobody in that system needs money to survive. Perhaps not coincidentally, those type of communities where they're non-monified are defined by the IMF as the poorest of all and the most in need of attention. So if you can persuade somebody in that community, you're poor, your life would be better if you were rich, you should be selling your output rather than giving it away or bartering it. And once you sell it, then people need money to buy it. If you're a farmer, you won't be giving them rice if they haven't got money, if that's what selling means. So those people then need to start charging money for whatever it is that they're doing. And the toxic need for money infects the whole community. And so the whole process of lifting communities out of poverty can be understood as replacing the existing social bonds and cultural understandings by the culture of money. And what does the culture of money say? It says, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And if you can't pay, you shouldn't eat. That is the process that has been ongoing through a lot of my lifetime, all around the world. As Charles Eisenstein has pointed out, the realm of the moneyfied has continued to expand. But, as we see, things are going to be changing one way or the other. We will not be consuming resources at the exponentially growing rate. In fact, we're going to be taking decreasing amounts of oil out of the ground, which presents a challenge to those in charge of the money system. Well, this brings us to section two. The inconvenient truth is that the ideology of perpetual growth is doomed. Looking at an increasingly barren, toxic, and plundered world, we cannot keep doing what we're doing. That's the inconvenient truth, which would force those who run the money system to say, yes, that's what we've done up to now, we're going to change. And they don't want to do that. So instead of that, they've created a convenient untruth. Now, what's the convenient untruth? Ah, the financial crisis, the bad mortgage loans, the speculation, the housing bubble. And this is where a lot of details are thrown into the mix. People get confused and have endless debates, but the reality is actually very simple. We can't keep consuming in exponentially growing fashion. We can't have an exponentially growing money supply. The system of lending out money at interest is a modern equivalent of tribute, the way that the king used to demand money from his subjects because he was the king. Well, that was deemed unpopular, so that was rebranded as compound interest, and now people are in debt and they have to pay their debts, and the forces of the state and law and order are ready to wage in and take property from people if they don't continue to repay their debts. It's effectively the same thing, but with a slightly nicer face, and it can't continue. We're hitting the limits of exponential growth on the planet. In fact, we've exceeded the planet's capacity to put up with us, and if we don't change our ways very quickly, we're going to be facing mass starvation and collapse. And this is the reality which the system will not acknowledge. So it's presented as a matter of bookkeeping. Oh, what's the subtext there? Well, if it was due to false accounting entries, if it was due to something that was human created, then humans can fix it. Okay, we go through the books, we take out the bad loans. But as we've seen, this is not something which is going to be solved with that kind of approach. Now, how did the bankers organize this financial crisis? Well, in one sense, of course, it's inevitable. If you have a system predicated on exponential growth, then it's going to hit the buffers at some point. More and more people will find they can't economically manage, so all their loans are going to be foreclosed, and increasing scarcity of resources is going to be reflected in increasing prices, which is going to mean less and less people have the money to eat and so on. So in that sense, it was inevitable. But it was, I believe, also micromanaged, because very easy for those people who control the system to cause depressions. We've seen how, because people borrow money from banks, they are dependent upon new money being put into the system with which they can repay the interest on the bank loans. So how can banks create a wave of bankruptcies? All they need to do is to not grant as many new loans. That won't tell them exactly who's going to go bankrupt, but in the aggregate, they know that doing that will create bankruptcies because there isn't the money in the system to repay loans. And from 1929 to 1933, I think I've got that right, the amount of money was reduced by about a quarter, 27% of the money supply declined, thus prompting a wave of bankruptcies across the US, contributing to the Great Depression. Now, who could have organized such activity? Well, the financial system is set up as a power hierarchy. Commercial banks create money, but there are restrictions on their ability to do that, based on their possession of high-powered money. Where does that come from? It comes from central banks. And who's organizing central banks? Ah, this leads us back to the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, who got a mention in last week's show. I really do think we ought to have a show about them. In any case, these are the same central banks who have the ability, by pumping a lot of new money into the system, what has been euphemistically called quantitative easing. So let's take a few minutes out. This is the soundtrack to a YouTube video in which the concept of quantitative easing is explained.
Did you hear about the Fed?
No. What about the Fed?
They announced another round of the quantitative easing.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to make large asset purchases via PAMO.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to expand their balance sheet and buy treasuries.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to print a ton of money.
So why do they call it the quantitative easing? Why don't they just call it the printing money?
because the printing money is the last refuge of failed economic empires and banana republics, and the Fed doesn't want to admit this is their only idea.
So why do they want to print the money?
Because they say we have the deflation, and the deflation is very bad.
What is the deflation?
The deflation is when prices of the things we buy go down.
Isn't that good? Doesn't it mean the people can buy more of the stuff?
Yes, but the Fed said this is bad, especially during the recession.
So they think that during the recession, when the people have less money to buy the stuff, it is bad that the prices go down?
Yes, the Fed would rather have the inflation.
So why does the Fed think we have the deflation?
Because the CPI said so.
But aren't the food prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the gas prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the healthcare costs higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't tuition prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the taxes higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the subway fares higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the stock prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the bond prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
So what is deflating right now?
The only thing deflating, that I can see, is the Fed's credibility.
Did they have a lot of credibility to start with?
No.
Why not?
Because the Fed has been wrong about every major economic development in the past 20 years.
You mean they didn't see the internet stock bubble?
No. In fact, they helped fuel the internet stock bubble.
And they didn't see the housing bubble?
No, in fact, they helped cause the housing bubble.
And they didn't see the subprime crisis?
No, in fact, they told us subprime problems were contained right before the hit the fan and the Lehman went bankrupt.
So has the Fed ever been right about anything?
Let me see if I can think of anything. Nope, nothing.
Who runs the Fed?
The Fed is run by the Ben Bernanke.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of business experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no business experience.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of policy experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no policy experience.
Has the Ben Bernanke ever run in an election?
No, the Ben Bernanke has never run in an election.
So what qualifies him to run the Fed?
I don't know, maybe the fact that he has a nice beard.
But my plumber also has a nice beard, and I would not trust him to play God with the economy.
No, although when you call the plumber to fix something that is broken, they usually fix it, not break it more.
This is true, the plumber is clearly smarter than the Ben Bernanke.
Well, that is why he became a plumber, and not an economist.
How does the Fed execute the quantitative easing?
They print the money, and then they buy the treasury bonds.
Do they buy the treasury bonds from the Treasury Department?
No, they buy the treasury bonds from the Goldman Sachs.
You must be kidding me.
No.
So let me get this straight. If I want to buy the treasury bonds, with my money, I can buy them directly from the treasury.
Yes.
And if you want to buy the treasury bonds, with your money, you can buy them from the treasury.
Right.
But if the Ben Bernanke wants to buy the treasury bonds using the American people's money, he does not buy them from the treasury, he buys them from the Goldman Sachs?
Exactly.
And does the Goldman Sachs give them a good price?
Of course not, they are the Goldman Sachs, they make their living ripping off the American people.
But how is the Goldman Sachs able to do this?
The Fed announces what it is going to buy, and when it is going to buy, before it does the trade.
So the Goldman Sachs can front-run the Fed, and give them the worst possible price on the treasury bonds?
Yes, exactly.
And the Fed is okay with this blatant theft from the American people?
Of course, otherwise, the Fed would just buy the treasury bonds directly from the Treasury Department.
Who inside the Fed is responsible for the buying of the treasury bonds?
The buying of the treasury bonds is conducted by the New York branch of the Federal Reserve.
And who is in charge of the New York branch?
The head of the New York branch is the William Dudley.
And what did the William Dudley do before running the New York Fed?
Before running the New York Fed, the William Dudley was a partner at the Goldman Sachs.
So the guy in charge of the American people's money when dealing with the Goldman Sachs used to be a partner at the Goldman Sachs?
Yes.
And nobody has a problem with this?
Apparently not.
Is this an episode of The Twilight Zone?
I don't think so.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
So what you are telling me is that the Fed thinks prices are going down, when in fact they are going up?
Yeah.
And they think during the recession, with the high unemployment, it is better if the things people need to buy cost more money.
Correct. According to the Ben Bernanke, the inflation will create the jobs and improve the housing market.
Has this ever been tried before?
Yes, just last year the Fed tried the quantitative easing with $2 trillion.
Did that create the jobs?
No.
Did it help the housing market?
Not at all.
Did it help anybody at all?
Yes, it helped the Goldman Sachs.
How much of the money are they printing now?
$600 billion.
So even though the first $2 trillion did not create the jobs or improve the housing market, the Fed decided to do another $600 billion anyway?
Yes.
Who put the Ben Bernanke in charge?
The Ben Bernanke was first appointed by the President Bush, then he was reappointed by the President Obama.
But wasn't the President Obama supposed to bring the change?
Yes.
How is putting in charge the same fool, who has been wrong about everything, the change?
Well, under the President Bush, the Ben Bernanke only blew up the American economy. Under the President Obama, he is working on blowing up the entire global economy.
That does not sound like the change we can believe in.
Definitely not.
Who else supports the Ben Bernanke?
Most economists around the world think the quantitative easing is very dangerous.
Does anyone think it is a good idea?
Yes, the people at the Goldman Sachs.
Is this some kind of nightmare?
No, it is very real.
I want to bang my head against the wall.
You should not do that.
Why not?
Because the healthcare is too expensive.
But didn't the President Obama fix that?
No. But that is the subject of a whole other video. Goodbye.
So, what's the effect of this quantitative easing? Well, a thought experiment that I often do with the kids that I teach is to say, how would you feel if everybody in the whole country, instead of having 5 taka, that's the national currency here, had 500 taka? Instead of having 2 taka, you had 200. And as soon as I ask this, I see a wave of smiles break out across the class. People imagine mentally how much money they'd have. And it's sad to have to bring them down to earth, but of course, the only real change is that 2 noughts would appear on the end of all the price tags, and what currently costs 10 taka would cost 1,000 taka, and so on. That's what happens if all the money in the supply is multiplied by 100. But quantitative easing doesn't do that. Quantitative easing increases the amount of money available to whoever is issuing the money, the central banks and the commercial banks. So it doesn't increase your money. So the net effect, say, of a doubling of the money supply, if you don't get an increase in the money, is that although the face value of your money will be the same, its purchasing power will gradually decline until it gets to a half of what it was. Well, the national currencies, pounds, dollars, euros, and so on, are all being inflated in concert. Why in concert? Ah, well, there is this thing called the Bank for International Settlements, you see, which is coordinating the international bankers. Now, what would happen if they quantitatively eased, say, pounds, but not euros? People would notice there's a lot of these pounds floating around. Perhaps pounds aren't worth as much as they used to. I think we'll buy euros. So there would be capital flight from any currency, and the exchange rate would reflect the fact that massive quantitative easing is going on. But if they're all inflated in concert, then there's nowhere for people with assets to go. We'll look, there are alternatives in the future. The point I'm trying to make here is that national currencies are nearly useless as a store of value. Anybody who's lived through hyperinflation will note the fact. What is currently the preserve of countries like the Zimbabwe dollar is coming to a national currency near you, as national governments, increasingly lacking any other approaches, are carrying out quantitative easing. Expect a whole bunch of changes to how they calculate inflation statistics, and you could look at something like the price of gold as a reflection. That is a real commodity in limited amount. I'm not encouraging people to buy gold because there doesn't seem to be a lot of point in owning gold except for the possibility of selling it to other people. So I hope this will help explain why, as of yesterday when I made this recording, gold price and silver price are both record high. This is because the amount of dollars available has never been as great as it is now. So the main message of the crisis, as I see it, is this. You, ordinary person on the street, are going to have to work more and consume less. And people are going to have to consume less because there is less stuff available. But that's not to say they necessarily have to work more. I think the thing about getting people to work more, maybe, so that the plutocrats who created the crisis can continue their profligate consumption at ever-increasing levels. Now, it may also be, by making people work harder, this will decrease their leisure time, will decrease their thinking time, and therefore prop up the system for that much longer. Now, if they just said, look, we've passed a law, and the law says you guys all have to work more and consume less, people, even in the US and the UK, are not so broken down that they would necessarily take that and say, oh, well, that's what we have to do, the government has told us. But by presenting this as a financial crisis, by manipulating economic circumstances behind the scenes, this is no longer something special and out of the ordinary. This is fitting within people's frame of, oh, economics, we have to pay the bills. It seems extraordinary to me that the plutocrats can be involved in such blatant theft, as we heard about in episode 542, without huge uprisings and people refusing to go along with it. To understand why people continue to work within this frame, you might want to listen to Derek Jensen talking about the Jews in the ghetto in Poland. If you haven't heard that one, check it out. I'm looking here, section 3, this is called Wrong Questions, about commercial media, who are, of course, by their commercial nature, up for sale for whoever has top dollar. They've been feeding them the wrong questions, such as, have you heard this one recently? How can we keep the system running? They've been likening the financial crisis, you may have seen this in cartoons or figures of speech, to a ship. It's called the economy, and we're all in it. We've got to keep it afloat. What else can you do if you're in the middle of the ocean and the boat springs a leak? Well, you've got to keep the boat from going down or keep it afloat as long as possible. Hence the question, how can we keep the system running, our economic system? I think it's Michael Hudson, or was it Charles Eisenstein, who pointed out that when they're asking how can we keep the system running, they're really saying how can we keep debt on the books? How can we preserve the fiction that that piece of paper will be equatable in the future to a certain amount of real resources, which, looked at like that, we notice is a fiction. We've got a system based on exponential growth and consumption in a limited world. Well, we can't keep the system running. It's actually impossible to do so forever, and the longer we try and keep it running, the more of the world we see destroyed around us, the more of the real wealth of the world is sacrificed to maintain the privilege of the few. Another wrong question that is asked by the media, who is to blame? Is it predatory lenders? Is it the idiots at Lehman Brothers? Is it Ben Bernanke's fault? Is it the black guys who took out mortgages on their dodgy homes? Well, we've got to find these guys, this is the thinking, we'll find these guys and punish them, change the regulations, make sure nobody does it again. Well, there will never be an again, because this is not a bookkeeping matter. This is not a matter of bad apples. This is a systemic problem. We're never going to face this again. Certainly not going to go away by putting people in jail. Perhaps the issue there is to diffuse public anger. Certainly the issue is to make people think that this is not a systemic crisis, that this is something of a routine matter. Hence questions like, how long will the recovery take? When will we be back to normal? Answer, it's not going to happen. We will not be back to normal, where normal means ever-increasing levels of debt, ever-increasing levels of consuming the world's natural resources. This isn't 1930, where we can decrease the money supply, drive a lot of wealth from the hands of individuals into the hands of a few rich bankers, and then get back to business. This isn't going to happen. So questions like, how can I protect the value of my fortune, my financial assets, my bank balance, whilst they may be on a lot of people's minds, are really missing the point. Paper wealth is just paper, not wealth. And you, singular, can't, because your piece of paper isn't worth anything to anybody. without a system to persuade people that it's of value. And ultimately, it isn't of value. Real wealth is something we must not confuse with paper claims on value. Questions like, how can I make the most profit out of the coming collapse? Show the spirit of the age, as Chomsky refers to it, the selfishness, but it misses the point. Don't think I, think we. I don't think how can we get the most, although that's kind of a religion of economics. There's enormous amounts of work on optimal this and that and the other, maximal pricing, getting the most money from other people, therefore putting them in debt to the maximum extent. Well, there's a Bengali saying that you can only eat so much rice. So after a certain point, nobody needs any more or looks for any more. That's, of course, true in terms of rice, in terms of the real world. It's not true in terms of money. However much you have, you may want more. And in a competitive system where people piling up money does not equate to piling up wealth, money only works because there's a scarcity of it, because people feel they need it. Now, this is perhaps the core of this presentation, and I think let's take a break. This is from Mark Achbar's film The Corporation. This is a stock market trader describing his experience on the trading floor. This may be the apotheosis of money psychosis.
The traders who are involved in the market are not guys whose moral fiber, when it comes to environmental conditions, are going to be rattled at all. They're seeing dollars and they're making money. There are no markets that you will not trade because of, you know, how you feel about it. No. Brokers don't stay away from copper because it violates their religious beliefs or their environmental policies. No. There are times when you think about it, but it's fleeting. It really is a fleeting moment. It's like, you know, yeah, oh yeah, well, the town's being polluted down there in Peru, but hey, this guy needs to buy some copper. I'm getting paid a commission, too. If we were more, you know, educated on what's really going on in third world countries with the production of these things, then obviously I think, you know, there might be, you know, a bigger movement. There might be more of a moral struggle. But right now, we don't know. Our information that we receive does not include anything about the environmental conditions. Because until the environmental conditions become a commodity themselves or being traded, then obviously we will not have anything to do with that. It doesn't come into our psyche at all. If suddenly we have clean air is now a commodity, then of course, hey, they're polluting it down in Peru, that one is going down. There's a difference. But as it stands right now, that's not yet a factor. It's not yet become a commodity, so we're not thinking about that, and we don't have any reason to. I gotta be honest with you, when the September 11th situation happened, I didn't know that. And I must say, and I wanna say this because it's, I wanna take it lightly. It's not a light situation. It's a devastating act. It was really a bad thing. It was one of the worst things I've seen in my lifetime, you know. But I will tell you, and every trader will tell you, who was not in that building and who was buying gold and who owned gold and silver, that when it happened, the first thing you thought about was, well, how much is gold up? The first thing that came to mind was, my God, gold must be exploding. Fortunately for us, all our clients were in gold. So when it went up, they all doubled their money. All I could think about was getting them the hell out. I mean, until we found out the building was collapsing. But before the building collapsed, all we were thinking about was, let's get those clients out. They've all doubled their money. Unfortunately, we couldn't get them out right then because the markets closed right afterwards. And then in the next couple of days, we got them all out. They all doubled their money. Everybody doubled their money. It was a blessing in disguise. Devastating, crushing, heart-shattering. But on a financial sense, for my clients that were in the market, they all made money. Now, I wasn't looking for this type of help. But it happened. When the U.S. bombed Iraq, back in 1991. The price of oil went from $13 to $40 a barrel, for Christ's sake. Now, we couldn't wait for the bombs to start raining down on Saddam Hussein. We were all excited. We wanted Saddam to really create problems. Do whatever you have to do. Set fire to some more oil wells, because the price is going to go higher. Every broker was chanting that. There was not a broker that I know of that wasn't excited about that. And then all of a sudden they said the war is going to be over a lot faster than we thought. We were all thinking this thing could drag out for a couple of months here. Price could really get out of hand. It could get to $50, $60, $70, $80. People were talking $70, $80. But we were excited about it because this was a disaster. This was something that was, you know, catastrophe happening, bombing, wars. In devastation, there is opportunity.
The pursuit of profit is an old story, but there was a time when many things were regarded either as too sacred or too essential for the public good to be considered business opportunities. They were protected by tradition and public regulation.
So this corruption of thinking, this focusing on money, may be widespread in Western society, a mass delusion, particularly in cities, but it doesn't make it any less of a delusion. Focusing on money blinds people to other value systems. I've heard about recent proposals to try to extend teaching about economic literacy to primary age children, trying to catch them as young as possible and ensure that they see the world in a certain way. In episode 543, The Corruption of Money, we looked at how human language reflects our ideas of money and also reinforces them. Just to pick one example, note that financial compensation is now so ubiquitous. It wasn't when I was a youngster. I noticed that it came in. It's now so ubiquitous, it's called just compensation. So on the screen, there's an equation of a hospitalized, injured-looking guy plus a pile of bills equals a healthy-looking guy. How is that possible? That being injured plus a certain amount of money equals being healthy. Well, perhaps you think that's common sense. If you get injured, somebody has to pay you money, whoever injured you, to make up for the damage. And if that seems like common sense, self-evident to you, then I'd like you to reflect on the fact that a healthy person can do a lot of things, like cut wood, cook, build a house, do whatever, which sick person plus pile of bills can't do. Now maybe you're thinking, oh, but he can spend his money and he can pay someone else to do it. Well, not if there isn't someone else who's willing to take that money and do it for him. And we're looking at a world in which the real resources are increasingly being sacrificed for the sake of financial resources, which is actually a fiction, which amounts to perpetuating the hierarchical system of control. When we talk about financial compensation, all of that is encapsulated in a single word, in a phrase like, how much is he worth? As if a human being were a product. The language of money obscures reality and it reflects our thinking, which is also obscuring reality. This kind of corruption of decision-making is actually central to perpetuating the power of money and perpetuating people's belief that there is some kind of financial crisis. David Corton quotes, "The minister responsible for Malaysia's forests explained that since money grows faster than trees, Malaysia will be better off once it has cut down all its trees and put the money in the bank to earn interest." Now, I suggest perhaps only if you're an economist does that make a lot of sense. If you see it as a valuable insight, I would seek therapy. If you take a squirrel's perspective, I don't think you'd understand that cutting down all the trees and replacing them with a number on a computer would somehow increase your well-being. But the fact that people can actually state these things, not only believe them, which is sinister enough, but actually come out and state them, the fact that people tolerate that is a reflection of how widely held money psychosis actually is. Now, I call it psychosis because it's kind of a delusion, but it shares a lot of characteristics with psychopathy, the lack of a conscience, very much connected to how money works. And remember, Homo economicus, the basis of the modern economic system, admitted such, talks about we will assume that people have no conscience. They have no thought for other people, and they have unlimited appetites. Modern economics, at its very nature, is psychopathic. Now, I'm not saying all guys who run businesses are psychopaths. I'm not even saying all guys who run businesses are sociopaths. I use the term differently. For me, psychopath is somebody with an innate disability, an innate lack of a conscience, whereas a sociopath is somebody through abuse, economics training, or whatever, somebody who has lost their capacity for empathy. Now, psychopathy is effectively untreatable, and I don't think the same is true of sociopathy. In fact, I'm confident it's not, because people who are inside one worldview, who see the world in a certain way, can escape and see the world differently. And I think that the mass delusion of money psychosis at some point in the next few years will lift on a global scale. Perhaps it's starting to recede already as people are understanding the perversity of the modern situation, in which, measured in terms of money, people are better off than they've ever been, yet measured in real terms, the very converse is true. Yes, psychopaths who don't have a conscience and sociopaths who behave as if they have no conscience often find their way to the top of large companies and companies headed by people with ethical concerns, people with alternative value sets, as we looked in episode 543, don't prosper because the money system is not set up to reward that. The modern day money system, zero sum, would actually reward people who arrange for a lot of other people to die. Now, that's another way to look at what's going on. Billions of people in the world are in dire material situations, and who would possibly want that? You'd have to be pretty sick in order to try to engineer that. But modern economics, with its zero-sum mentality, is saying, yes, well, there is scarcity in the world, and if the world's asset base is shared between people, then the fewer people who have it, the more everyone gets. So whilst any healthy human being would see mass starvation as a terrible disaster, and certainly that's how I understood it as a teenager when I first understood about mass starvation in Africa, that was a few decades ago, and not a lot seems to have changed. So I think we can conclude from this either that nobody has the power to change it, which I do not believe, or that those people who have the power do not have the will, which I do believe. And why don't they have the will? Well, we've just mentioned their value system doesn't reward people. In fact, desperate people can be exploited to a greater extent than independent people. So I've spoken for quite a while on the money psychosis, but I think that's really the heart of understanding the financial crisis, the confusion between money and the real world. I mean, that's a confusion, particularly with respect to the crisis itself, which commercial media have certainly been trying to induce, talking about the financial crisis as some sort of financial tsunami or an economic earthquake, likening it to a natural disaster. Now, a natural disaster affects everybody, rich or poor, and a natural disaster damages real wealth. Buildings get destroyed, people get killed, real world infrastructure gets damaged. In the financial crisis, so-called, this doesn't happen. As I think it was Bill Still from the Money Masters pointed out to me many years ago, in the financial crisis, money is transferred. Control over real resources passes from one person's hands to another. Whilst commercial media are designed for the consumption of those people who are losing their jobs, losing their homes, their businesses, who are undergoing tough times, they present it as if everybody is suffering. But, as we know from the nature of money, one person's loss is another's gain. The perspective which I have never heard mentioned on commercial media is that for everybody who is losing out, somebody is gaining. And if almost everybody is losing out, then it's a tiny minority who are gaining. These are the same tiny minority, more or less, who are also awarding themselves billions and trillions of dollars into the bargain by dint of their control of the legislative process. Now, why do they need to do this? Well, remember this, they don't need money. Now, that might be tricky for an ordinary person to grasp because many people are inculcated to believe, yes, of course we need money, the more money we have, the better. But it's really true. The people at the top of the money system, because, yes, they are people, remember, people often think, no, it's a faceless powers that be. No, they're human beings. Psychopath or not, these people are humans, and they are not short of money. For them, the game is about power. They have to get people to go along with this system, because they are afraid that their power will suddenly collapse, that people will not seek this money that they're trying so hard to make people think they need. This is section 5, the future, a short section. I've said that increasingly vehement and principled resistance to the ideology of domination and hierarchy will be labelled as terrorism by an overtly totalitarian system. The system in the US arguably is not totalitarian at the moment, at least not overtly. I suggest it's pretty much totalitarian, but it has the facade of democracy. Yes, the elections were rigged, and quite a lot of people know that the elections were rigged, and yes, they are torturing people, and yes, there's no writ of habeas corpus. Increasingly, judgments are made by unaccountable officials. All of this is true, but they maintain the fiction of democracy. The iron hand is still in the velvet glove. Well, increasingly, I'm expecting that glove to come off, and people talk about things like FEMA camps and so on, and yes, things might get pretty sticky in the US, but people therefore will be resisting with increasing vehemence, and I said increasing principle because these kind of systems are being increasingly understood with shared information, particularly using the internet. Now, new technology, the top one is Bitcoin, which you can get from bitcoin.org. This is something like a decentralized PayPal. So if you've ever used PayPal, it's a website you can go to send money to people. You type in your credentials and how much money you'd like to send them, and hey presto, it sends it. Now that's PayPal, and it requires you go to their site, and of course they manage everybody's accounts. So if they want to freeze WikiLeaks' account or someone else's account, they can do that. They have that power. This technology, Bitcoin, is not centralized, so you have to get the software, but you can then run it on your computer without needing to go through a central website. There's nobody who's in charge, which makes it helpful for those people who are trying to evade control by centralized systems. And then you type in who you'd like to send the money to and how much. Now that's one point, centralization. Another crucial point, this is perhaps the most interesting, is that it's not denominated in dollars. And no, it's not denominated in euros or yen or anything which is familiar. It's denominated in bitcoins. This is a digital currency created by the programmers themselves. I can't explain the technical side here, but maybe you're asking, well, how much is a bitcoin worth? And the answer is, how much is an ounce of gold worth? Well, it's whatever the price is. It does have a market rate against the dollar and other more familiar currencies, and it does float. And yes, as well as swapping it for currencies, you can buy things with it. You can buy coffee, you can buy software, you can buy books, you can buy a bunch of stuff. So it's an emerging market, and I don't think it is the answer. I don't think it is what is going to replace money, but it points the way. It has one crucial flaw, which is that the mathematical model which underpins it requires that at least half of the computing power which runs the system is not intent on subverting it, which I think may be a problem if, for example, somebody in HSBC or Google or the NSA decides, well, we've had enough of this Bitcoin, I think it's time to crash the system, then they could run some rogue software, interface it with the Bitcoin software that exists, and because of their enormous server farms, which they can run 24/7, rather than a few million users with their random computers which are on as and when, that would dominate the system and likely have sufficient resources to bring it down, by which I mean that transactions would become garbled and null and void, multiple spending attacks and so on. So Bitcoin, I think, is not the answer, but a shape of things to come. If they can fix that central flaw, expect good things. In the meantime, you might want to go there and try it out anyway. I found it fun. Low-tech solutions, I'm going to mention here something that I hope to do a show on later. I've been running in Bangladesh for a short time. I did gift circles, which is very simple in concept. People meet up, introduce themselves, people talk about what they'd like to get, what they request other people, and then they talk about what they can offer, and then the two get matched up. So there's no bartering, it's not a trading system, it's just a way to meet and to help meet one another's needs. And that's called Gift Circle, if you want to look it up. There's a few videos about that. I think starting a gift circle might be one of the best ways that people can prepare for the difficult transition ahead. Now, why did I say difficult? Well, if you're listening to this show, you may be less confused about what's going on. But if you're a regular watcher of mass media, then you're subject to a lot of misinformation and distraction, endless discussions about mortgage rates and interest payments and complex financial vehicles designed to make you shrug your shoulders and think, well, it's too hard for me, I don't know what's going on, and also to demonize disruptive technologies and disruptive ideas. If you hear about things like Bitcoin being used for child pornography or money laundering or some other nominally terrifyingly dangerous thing, then I wouldn't be at all surprised. More and more people will find themselves in increasing material poverty, and that may be seen as sufficient grounds to lock people up and put them in work camps. The ideology of the strict father, the market ideology, which says being poor is a result of being lazy or being stupid, that is used to underpin increasingly strict measures. I forget what large proportion of Americans is on food stamps, but it's certainly a large number, and I would, if I was on food stamps, consider that as a sign to try and get out of this system, try and look at other alternatives. Expect increasingly hungry people to lose their illusions about the financial systems, to lose the importance of the imprinting that's been carried out, and increasingly to make their dissatisfaction known. As we heard a couple of weeks back on the show about Libya and the Arab world, lack of food may have been a major factor influencing what's going on. Well, that, I think, is going to be a global phenomenon. So, to conclude the final section, important questions.